And it's such a shame that the arguments about the global war on terror and yeah, the fatigue that we experienced because the strategy was incoherent is being pushed forward into the Ukraine discussion, because it's an apples to pancakes comparison.
This is the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast listeners. My name is Rob, and with me today I have both Cheryl Rover, whom all of you are familiar with, and our guest today is Kathleen McInnes of the CSIS, which is a Center for Strategic. But you just go ahead and say it and introduce yourself, please.
It is not the Canadian CSIS, it's the American one, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And I have a couple of roles there. One, I'm a senior fellow in the International Security Program, and I'm also the director of the Smart Women, Smart Power Initiative. I like long walks on the beach. what else about me? Fun facts. I've worked in the UK House of Commons at one point. I'm a Pentagon and Capitol Hill refugee. And I'm actually technically a doctor of war, having gotten my PhD in war studies.
Well, yes, for war studies. Now, you also have a one-year-old who's having a birthday party soon. Is that what I also heard?
That is correct. And the theme of that party is going to be survival. Like, we made it. that's all I got.
In my experience, they only really start caring about birthdays around age three, but mine definitely became intensely interested in what their party would look like and the themes and the execution, and of course, deeply skeptical about their parents' ability to make anything that they wanted happen by about age three. So,
I can see that coming down the pike. Yep.
It has been a good long time since this podcast has tackled events in Ukraine. And since we do have a national security group here, let's start off by taking a look at that. I'll start with you, Cheryl. What are your impressions of the situation, both in terms of what's going on in Ukraine right now, and in terms of the congressional process that seems finally to be moving in a direction, some kind of direction, just over the past week? So I guess starting off, your impressions, and then Kathleen, your impressions, and we'll just go from there.
Yeah, I think I'll talk about Ukraine first. The positive things that Ukraine has been doing has been taking out ships in the Black Sea. for not having a navy, they have engaged in a pretty impressive naval war. And I think, let's see, there were two or three ships taken out this past week. And they have taken out a total of something like a third of the Russian ships in the Black Sea fleet, which is, wow, that is really impressive. They have these surface drones that have their nice little cameras to show us what's happening as they approach, and then the blank out. And Russia doesn't seem to have much defense against that. Otherwise, on the ground, there's more or less of a standstill. The Russian offensive has not gone very well. They did make some breakthroughs a week or two ago, and there was some expectation they'd capitalize on that, and that doesn't seem to have happened. On the other hand, the Ukrainians haven't done much either. And so stuff is where it is. As far as Congress is concerned, there are a few people I'd like to take a 2x4 to the head to. what the Republicans are doing is indefensible. Both in terms of just national strategy, morality, anything you want to talk about. And it's also bizarrely in contrast to past Republican approaches to foreign policy. So I'll let Kathleen say something.
Well, I guess I'll do the reverse. I'll start with Congress and then maybe get back to the ground. It's been disappointing. It's been frustrating. It's been horrible to watch congressional inaction given the profound stakes at play. And it's a point that like in nerd circles, like mine, like we talk about how strategically important it is, but I don't think we talk about it actually enough outside of our world. Like if Ukraine falls, European security, transatlantic security becomes profoundly more challenging. And oh, by the way, it's not going to be that long until the American taxpayer is also profoundly affected. We're having economic shocks. We're having, you know, perceptions of a sluggish economy. The Biden administration will tell you otherwise. But even so, this gets exponentially worse if the conflict in Ukraine expands because Ukraine does not survive. And truly, the end game in this conflict, if Russia wins, is that Ukraine and Ukrainians do not survive. This is a genocidal war where war crimes are almost the way of war. When I was in Ukraine last August, one woman said to me, you know, there are fates worse than death. That is what a Ukrainian collapse, a Ukrainian loss means to the Ukrainians themselves. That's also why they literally, like, they will fight to the bitter end for the pre-2014 territories, right? Like a full Ukraine, including Crimea. It's because of the war crimes, because of the heinousness of Russian occupation, they want to liberate their brothers and sisters in Eastern Ukraine. So all this is to say, so it's heinous that Congress has been so slow to move. I think Lindsey Graham has given us a way out in this sort of low interest forgivable loan proposal. I think that is probably the way that the circle is going to be squared. But so in the next couple of weeks, my sense is talking to folks on the Hill is that we might see some movement here. The bigger question is how do we interact with, to an extent, empathize with, like strategically empathize with, members of Congress and American constituencies who do not understand, or if they understand, they do not care about Ukraine, right? This isn't something that just goes away once this aid package is passed. This is something that is going to be a feature in our system for quite some time. So how do we grapple with that? I think that's the big question before all of us.
Yeah, I think that, and I read a fair amount of, what is broadly conceived as restrainer literature. And it seems to me, and Stephen Walt is a good example of this, it seems to me that when folks, and I'll throw this out there, that when folks, especially on sort of this restraint side, will talk about Ukraine and they'll talk about it in terms of, oh, well, the Americans have simply gotten tired of supporting Ukraine, right? That there was fatigue over supporting Ukraine. When in fact, that's not accurate at all, right? It is two things, right? It is American institutions, right? And in our particular institutional structure, we have a situation where an extremely small minority of folks can actually stop congressional action. And that extremely small minority of folks, it's nothing about restraint. It's nothing about a smaller American footprint. It is direct sympathy for Vladimir Putin's Russia. Right, that the people who are stopping aid package from going through are people who are directly and often explicitly sympathetic with the aims of an authoritarian power in Russia, right? Because they feel ideological sympathy with that power, right? And again, they are, J.D. Vance and Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Donald Trump are admirably open about this. Right. They will talk about Orban. Right. They will talk about, what a hero Tucker Carlson is for going to Russia and showing that Russians are actually awesome and great and wonderful. And yet this very frustrating response. And you know, these are people in some ways that I've admired in the past, like Stephen Walter, I admire now, like Stephen Wertheim. They talk about it as if it's, oh, well, this is fatigue, right? This is being tired, right? This is just not having enough. No, it's not, right? And when you talk about it that way, you're not engaging with the problem, right? And I can see why you don't want to engage with the problem, because people don't want to think that there are quasi-fascists in Congress right now who are stopping Ukraine aid. But that's the problem right now. So that's like sort of my domestic problem.
Just a quick reflection. The realist restrainer side, school of thought, had particular salience to me when we were in the global war on terror days, right? The military operations we became embroiled in, chose to initiate in the case of Iraq, were plagued with bad strategy or resourcing. It's hard to stick put your finger on it. Did we lose these wars because of bad tech? Did we lose the wars because of bad strategy? Chicken and egg, who knows? That's why we've got a war commission. But the war in Ukraine is profoundly different. This is not sort of, checking an imperialist impulse when we're bad at it. This is fighting for a global order in which economies can interact and markets can thrive, and that human dignity can be expressed and realized. We are literally fighting for the world we want to live in. That's not realist restrainer material, right? The stakes are so much higher. And it's such a shame that the arguments about the global war on terror, the fatigue that we experienced because the strategy was incoherent, is being pushed forward into the Ukraine discussion, because it's an apples to pancakes comparison.
Right. I mean, it feels like there are a lot of people who essentially, and not someone like Stephen Walt, but there are a lot of people in the conversation who cut their teeth on arguments about the war on terror. Right. And arguments on the war about the war on terror, and especially arguments against the war on terror, placed you in a specific position in a whole bunch of conversations that people wanted to have, arguments about the national or the United States. I hate the term military industrial complex, but the DIB, right, the sort of broader national security state. And, those arguments, that experience felt like it permanently put people on a side, even when the circumstances change, right? This is a much different situation than Afghanistan or Iraq, and therefore, our response to it should be different. And that doesn't seem complicated to me, right? But people have built, their identities and their media persona and so forth around, and I'll have more thoughts on this later too, but around, right, that if Lockheed Martin is happy, you should be sad, right? And that's it. Right. And whether it's Ukraine or Iraq or Afghanistan, that's basically what should guide your thinking on foreign policy and intervention. And it's just nonsense. And I wish it was more obvious to people that it was just nonsense. If I could talk a bit about the situation in Ukraine. Right. So I was there in probably not long after you came back, Kathleen, because we got there in September, and I was there with Matt Duss, who's now at CIP, used to be Bernie Sanders' foreign policy guy. I think that on the ground, the Russians have yet to demonstrate that they can exploit Ukrainian vulnerability to make significant changes at the front. But I wouldn't put it past them, if the current situation continues, them being able to develop that capability, right? Sort of a maneuver, mobile maneuver strike capability that is able to generate breakthroughs in the Ukrainian lines and that is able to exploit those breakthroughs, right? We're not there yet. They're not there yet. And there are obstacles to them being able to do it. But that seems to be the direction we're trending on the ground. The naval war is really interesting, right? Because the naval war is analogous in a lot of ways to the Ukrainian air campaign, because it's about creating pain for Russia. But that's all it is, right? It's not decisive. The entire Russian Black Sea fleet could be destroyed tomorrow, and Russian military operations on the ground are not going to be consequentially hampered. And so the naval campaign, which has been very successful from the Ukrainian point of view, and it's going to be really interesting for a long time for naval analysts, because, and I talk about this in my classes, right? What's the last naval war we have, right? 1982, right? And so that's what naval people have to go back to, is like, think about 1982. But it's not going to save Ukraine, right? That Ukraine destroying the Black Sea Fleet is not going to win this war for Ukraine.
It does make Crimea easier to retake. Right. And that, that's, I mean, and let's not forget that that's a big part of the Ukrainian war aim.
Another thing that Ukraine has been doing to cause pain to Russia, and like you say, this isn't going to win the war, but it certainly keeps the war in the forefront of some Russians' minds anyway, is they've been attacking oil refining capabilities in Russia. And I saw a map this week that oil refineries within the range of what Ukraine can manage are being hit pretty badly. And I think the capacity was a third down, something like that. Anyway, a significant amount, maybe 20%. This was brought home to me when the Ukrainians hit Ust-Luga, because when I was working at Sillamäe in Estonia, and part of what that project was to develop a port. The port was in competition with Ust-Luga, which is a little further east on the Gulf of Finland. And the big thing that's been going out of Sillamäe and Ust-Luga has been oil. Mm-hmm. And Ust-Luga's capability in that has now been damaged. I've been wondering, I haven't heard, but I've been wondering what the situation has been with Sillamäe, because Russia isn't going to be willing to give Estonia much business. But on the other hand, they really want to sell that oil.
Right. I'll throw this out there and see what you guys think about it. It feels to me like the naval war, the strikes against Russian oil refineries, the broader sanction war, right? All of these are things that matter, but, it reaffirms, for me, right, and I still study air power, right, but one of the big things about air power historically has been that fundamentally strategic air campaigns aren't decisive, right, that they cannot on their own be decisive, right, they can't even on their own be decisive if you're incinerating cities like we did in World War II, and the Ukrainians and the sanctions campaign are far short of what we were doing to Germany and Japan in World War II. And so Russia and Serbia and lots of other countries that have come under air campaigns and sanctions campaigns, that they can hold on, right? It's damaging, but they can hold on. Because fundamentally, these campaigns, they matter, but they're not decisive to the conflict. In the way that we were talking about them, the sanctions campaign being decisive in February of 2022, right? Or we were hoping that it would be decisive in 2022. And I think people can go too far in the other direction, right? It is not actually the case that Russia's economy is better now than it was in February of 2022. But they're nice to have, but they don't actually produce the conditions to force Russia to accept a ceasefire or to accept a particular territorial configuration.
I mean, Russia's lost how many 100,000, 300,000 and change in casualties for this war? I mean, their risk threshold is pretty high. And Putin has demonstrated in the past that he's quite okay with pyrrhic victories. That's what we're fighting against. And so routinely see calls for negotiations with Russia. Let's have some sort of ceasefire. A ceasefire is a strategic pause, right? And to allow Russia to regroup and go in again. This is not... I don't see the conditions under which we could have a negotiated agreement anytime soon. This is going to be a slog, right? And eventually what's going to happen is Russia's going to have to decide that just continuing to bite at this apple is not worth it anymore, perhaps by being distracted by other priorities. Who knows? But this is going to last a long time. Ammunition matters, turns out.
Right. Well, I mean, it did seem as if Russia really was taken aback by the terrorist attack. That was something outside of Putin's narrative. They tried in very clumsy ways to connect it with Ukraine. It doesn't seem like, I mean, sort of the there are upsides and downsides of the generally cynical character of the Russian approach to media, right? And I say this on the part of the population, right? They just assume everybody's lying all the time, and so therefore nothing is a pretty big deal. But it also means that I don't think the Russian government has, I don't think Putin is going to be able to build a narrative around these ISIS attacks, which connects them to the Ukraine war, right? And so that might be consequential in terms of Russian public opinion eventually, depending on what happens eventually with the campaign. So
also watch the women and the mothers.
Right.
That space. Losing over 300,000 men at the front of the conflict. This has reverberations. We saw this at the end of the Soviet Union.
Right.
Watch the mothers.
So how about we connect this conversation to NATO and the NATO 75th? Now, and again, I don't know if you guys read it. I read it. I was left profoundly irritated by it. Stephen Walt, who has been a pretty long-term critic of at least NATO expansion, said we should give up on any chance or on any ambition to bring Ukraine into NATO, right? It will only extend the war. And anyway, and the worst part of his column, this was a foreign policy column a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, neutrality isn't bad. Just ask the Finns, right? The Finns, they loved being neutral during the Cold War. And I think he immediately got just tremendous, tremendous pushback on this. But I guess I'll throw out the question, which is, what does this war mean for NATO, and what can NATO mean for the rest of this war?
I'll just quickly throw in, I've talked to some Finns, and I don't think Stephen Walt has talked to many Finns.
Yeah. But,
NATO's role in this and where NATO is going is really a conundrum right now. It's really hard for me anyway to see Ukraine being brought into NATO as long as the war is on. NATO does have a restriction about conflicts, and there's also a stipulation that boundaries have to be firm, although that was somewhat overridden for the Baltic countries when they were brought into NATO, because they were still disputing some of their boundary issues with Russia. So the boundary issue is not a big one, but to bring in a country that is actually at war with Russia, I don't see how that happens.
You've asked the perfect and yet ridiculously hard question, right? Because, you know, in NATO land, it is very obvious that what happens in Ukraine will profoundly impact transatlantic security, either for better or ill. The operating assumption, and you know, is that, and I haven't heard much pushback on this anymore. That if Ukraine falls, Putin starts to try to take a bite at other apples. You know, Moldova would be next, but then looking up at the Baltics, right? And there's no appetite suppressant. So what NATO's response has been to date has been twofold. One, to assure Ukraine that its future is in NATO when conditions are met. And it's not just, you know, is the war over? It's also, you know, there's all sorts of like civilian control of the military, those sorts of things that they've said that they're not going to do, that like the comprehensive action plan, kind of like membership action plan, but those sorts of things will still be factoring in people's minds. So Ukraine's future is in NATO. Hooray. But God knows when that's going to be, as Cheryl just pointed out. The other thing that NATO has been doing is working on its suite of plans and capabilities to ensure that it can defend alliance territory, so that in case Russia does decide to take bites at the NATO apple itself, that the alliance is prepared. And let's not forget, you know, Putin basically articulated the strategy here to take down NATO in 2007 at the Munich Security Conference. So it's not like this is debatable stuff. This is the intention is to destroy NATO. Okay. So we got to take him at his word. So NATO turned 75 this week on April 4th. NATO countries, NATO members are doing a lot to support Ukraine with military and other aid, but the alliance itself has stayed out of it because it's the alliance itself doesn't want to get into a war with Russia. So yeah, NATO's like walking this very delicate line. The question is, again, is it enough? And if Ukraine falls, will that be proof, you know, case in point, proof positive of why, you know, the alliance is no longer relevant to 21st century security requirements? So lots on the line.
So either of you, I'm curious, would you say more is on, and I know these two things are connected, right? Is more on the line based on the survival of Ukraine or based on the outcome of the November 2024 election in the United States with respect to NATO?
Survival of Ukraine is what I would articulate, if forced to make the choice, because obviously there's interrelationships there.
Right.
At the end of the day, there are a number of Republicans who do believe in the enduring value of the NATO alliance, right? And many of those will be joining the administration. And so, you know, stuff may happen at the very senior strategic levels, you know, heads of state level, but like there's ballast within our system. Ukraine falling is an invitation for more war in the European theater. And whether the alliance is capable of meeting that challenge of more, you know, a metastasized and spread conflict across the European theater, that will be enormously difficult for NATO to handle, right? There's this really great line in the 2018 National Defense Strategy. They have this like commission, National Defense Strategy Review Commission, And they basically grade the government's homework on the national defense strategy. And they wrote this line that they were worried that the United States was essentially at risk of strategic insolvency, essentially that we hadn't spent enough money on defense and capabilities necessary to actually accomplish the tasks that we set out for the United States military and our defense establishments. And one wonders if we're going to, if in that post-Ukraine collapse scenario, if NATO will truly be in that situation of strategic insolvency, given underinvestment in European defense programs for decades.
That's an interesting phrase, strategic insolvency. And what you're saying is a matter of insolvency relative to financial issues.
I also think in terms of like military investment and capability investment. Like,
That's okay. What I'm intending. Perhaps didn't say it exactly right, but I'm also thinking that the November election could give us a strategic insolvency in terms of confidence and unity within the organization. If Trump wins, boy, all bets are off on a lot of things. The 2025 strategy that they've issued, it's good to think that there are some Republicans, and there are indeed some Republicans, who still see the value of NATO and who would support that. But what Donald Trump and some of the people close to him have in mind is for a real deconstruction of the government and all power to Trump. So it's just hard to see how those people might make a difference if Trump goes whole hog on tearing things down. And certainly he has not liked NATO, and he is quite explicit that he wants to get out of NATO and let those silly Europeans take care of their silly wars. And oh, by the way, Putin would probably be good at taking care of all that for them. I mean, that really seems to be the way he thinks. And this time he will know much more what to do to get power over the various government agencies.
Right. And, you know, I guess this is kind of a follow-up and kind of a follow-up to your question, Kathleen, or to the point you were making, Kathleen. What do we make of Macron's newfound aggressiveness, or at least rhetorical aggressiveness, with respect to European responsibilities in Ukraine, right? I mean, is this sort of traditional French, desire to take the podium, right? Or is this really sort of a hedging, saying like, look, we're still in this, even if the Americans fall apart, right? Because I get the strategic insolvency bit, but listening to Macron, he seems really to be more engaged in this Ukraine thing than he's been in the past. Sort of more willing to conceive of a Europe that is strategically relevant, led by a France that is strategically relevant, of course, but that's how these things work.
I mean, sure, we've seen these sort of shifts and swings and roundabouts over the decades, right? And it gets into Atlanticist versus Europeanist foreign policies and security policies. And my read is, that Macron is a little bit more practical and a little bit more beyond those theologies, right? He's looking at, just as most allies around the world are, looking at the American institutions and our political discourse, and this expression of, I guess, neo-isolationism, let's call it that, That's not just in the, you know, presidential candidate Trump. It's also, you know, in other parts of the system and within Congress, right? It's other parts of the institutions. So, you know, and also recognizing the stakes in Ukraine, it's time to step up, right? The supplemental has taken last August that it was put on the table, last July. It's taking a profoundly ridiculously long amount of time to fund the supplemental. And Europe has to start, you know, has been doing quite a lot, but is going to have to do even more. Even if we get the supplemental, like just looking forward, looking at the political currents, Europe does need to do more. Europe does need to step up to do more. And I feel like Macron is positioning himself and trying to position the European continent to do so. But again, where I sort of step back a little bit from what I said earlier about the Atlanticist versus the Europeanist stuff, I don't get the sense that it's driven by that theology that we used to have about European Union versus NATO per se. Like, not, it doesn't feel like it's primarily driven by that discourse anymore. It seems like it's much more of a brass tacks. Oh God, we've got a bad situation. We've got to start figuring out what to do about it.
It is interesting to me too that for all that Ukraine and sort of Russia more broadly have come up a lot in European elections thus far, and have been, you know, become relevant in European politics, it doesn't seem to be an issue at all in the British election, right? That both British parties seem to be very firmly pro-Ukraine, and there doesn't seem to be any cracks there, and nobody appears to be trying to exploit any of those any of that on either side. I mean, I suppose, you know, one could possibly make the argument that the Tories are so out of ideas at this point that they, you know, and I think I did see a poll that showed them behind some far right party at some point. But you know, that they are sort of losing their grip on control over the center right in ways that bode poorly down the road for British politics. But still, it's interesting that Ukraine is not an issue in the British election, as far as I can tell. That's just an observation. Nobody has to answer that or observe it. But
yes. Now,
Cheryl, do you have any other thoughts on Ukraine or NATO at this point?
Oh, no, I think not.
I mean, if I could just add one more thing, like I've been a bit down on the alliance, I think, thus far. And that actually doesn't reflect my perspective, which is like NATO is an incredible institution. It is, you know, I did my PhD on coalition warfare, right? And it is very hard to pull militaries together and have them do things together on the ground and actually achieve anything. We've got this vibrant alliance that for 75 years has been bringing together disparate militaries, figured out a command and control system, and decision-making structures, and created space for some of the world's leading democracies to consult on strategic matters and make that matters. That's really, really important. If we didn't have NATO, we would want it now. But, you know, so I'm a big NATO nerd and big NATO proponent, but I'm also not going to pull the punch, right? Which is that if there is not a credible solution on Ukraine moving forward, it's going to have profoundly damaging impacts for the alliance itself. So the answer is support Ukraine. Support Ukraine.
Right. And, you know, and it's all, you know, to go back to the Black Sea thing, right? You know, Russia is now shut out of maritime spaces. It really is at the risk of being shut out of two major maritime spaces that it has historically been either dominant in or at least had a presence in. There is no meaningful Russian presence in the Baltic right now, right? And there won't be in the future. And whatever Russia can do in terms of its defense industry, it can't build ships, right? And it hasn't been able to build ships since the 1990s. And so the prospect of rebuilding the Black Sea fleet is just so distant at this point that You know, and those are two consequential effects of this war that perhaps the Russians perhaps should have thought more about at the time. So I do kind of, and this is one where sometimes I sit and think to myself, what books do I want to read after this war is over about this war, right? And one of the books, and this will be a really interesting one, definitely will be about civil-military relations in Ukraine and how, you know, you can call it Zelensky's generals or something like that, and how that, and that's obviously very interesting over the past 6 months. But I also, you know, I really want a book written about, like, did the Russians know that Finland and Sweden were going to immediately try to join NATO, right? Was that part of their calculation, or were they just so blind as to the impact that this war was going to have that they didn't grip that as part of their thinking? And I don't know the answer to that. Maybe you guys do.
I know where I would put my money.
I've wondered about that too. The Baltic situation is just dreadful for Russia. It's 65 kilometers, I believe, between Helsinki and Tallinn. And that is the access to St. Petersburg and all the shipyards in that area. Russia can be cut off so thoroughly. And I've been a little surprised that I haven't seen any threats coming from Russia about those terrible Finns and Estonians. Better not close that strait. But and indeed, there have been some little interactions over time about some of the islands in the Gulf of Finland that Russia owns, and anyway, back and forth. Some of Russia's big shipyards are there, and having that closed off means what they've got left is on the Pacific and in Murmansk. Mm-hmm. So that's strategically just terrible for them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, on another note of, did they know, how were they thinking? There was a really good article in the New York Review of Books about a month ago about Eurasianism, and it explained the thinking behind Eurasianism, and I had been sort of picking up a little bit of it along the way, and certainly some of the things that Putin had been saying were consistent with it, but this article really brought it home to me that Putin is thinking as a Eurasianist, and there's a lot of stuff in Eurasianism that probably has not contributed favorably to his strategizing about the whole situation.
Well, just recall that in the early days of the war, there were troops that did not know that they were being sent to war. They really thought that they were going to be able to change the facts on the ground before, you know, there'd be real consequences, right? Finland and Sweden joining NATO. So my money's on, let's call them strategic blind spots and lack of effective bureaucratic decision-making or communication. Like, how do you have a really good war plan if people don't even know they're going to war? Like, I just don't get it. Like, this is not how wars are won.
Right. And I think that, one answer to this may be that, or one part of this may be that, you know, that Putin's background is in intelligence, right? And so the people who put him where he is and the people that he caters to are intelligent, are professionals in the intelligence community, not military professionals, right? And not even really strategic professionals, because and I think people can get confused there, but because intelligence professionals are not necessarily strategic thinkers, right? They can be very conspiratorial, very bureaucratic, very inwardly focused. But, you know, I think, you know, from reviewing even the first few days of the war, Putin really expected that the intelligence community was going to deliver the greater portion of the victory, right? That the intelligence community, the Russian intelligence community, was going to open the pathway to Kyiv. You know, special forces and airborne would be able to seize Kyiv, and that was basically the game, right? That the intelligence professionals he surrounded himself with are going to be able to do this, and that may explain a lot of the sort of perverse decision making that came out of that came in the first few months of the war from Russia.
So, it makes me very.
Yeah, it could also add to minimizing. What are those people in Helsinki and Stockholm know anyway? And
right.
Those silly Finns and Swedes, that kind of thing. Although. I would have hoped that Russia had better intelligence feelers into those capitals, but maybe not. Estonia, for example, has been very effective against Russian intelligence.
It makes me very nervous about things like crisis escalation and crisis communication. How contemporary Russia think, you know, take strategic decisions relative to how the Soviet Union did. It's a different kettle of fish. And the bubble that Putin, the information bubble around Putin seems to be very, very solid. So what does that mean in terms of deterrence signaling and actually, you know, the communication of those discernment signals, like he actually picks them. Like, there's a whole set of questions there that I don't feel like we've got, or maybe we'll never have good answers to.
Well, so for the ending here, we're getting actually pretty close to an hour, but for the ending, can we ask you about, or can I ask you, and Cheryl probably also wants to know, can you tell us a little bit more about the Smart Women, Smart Power initiative at CSIS? I think I know what it means, but can you tell us more about what it is and what direction you're going?
Well, I would be delighted to. The Smart Women, Smart Power initiative, it's actually 10 years old. This year, which is pretty incredible. It started as this, you know, in 2014, there was this recognition that we needed to actually take intentional steps to give women's voices the microphone, amplify their ideas and push them forward. And I think we've been reasonably successful on that. Although, you know, when I took this job 2 years ago, and I remember coming in and I thought, well, there's a lot of women in the administration. We made a lot of, maybe we can sort of deprioritize that effort. And oh my God, I was totally wrong. Completely wrong. This is something you just cannot take your hands off the wheel. So that's one of the missions of Smart Women, Smart Power is to continue to amplify the voices of leading women. We are also, from a research perspective, we've added a research agenda to what we're doing. One question we are teasing out is helping us understand what having women in decision-making spaces, particularly in international affairs, what it's actually getting us. So each podcast that I do, you can find them on all of your favorite podcasty channels, platform thingies for anybody who's listening. They're conversations with women where we talk about a key decision that they made or they were part of. And then we ask the question, did your gender have a role? And if so, why? And if not, why not? Transcripts are available on the CSIS website. So we've got primary source documentation there. And we'll be releasing our first report with the analysis of, you know, what we've discovered as part of the research process. We'll be publishing that in the next couple, like month or two. So that's pretty exciting. The other thing we're doing is trying to understand how the lens of gender and related to that, women, peace, and security tools can help us more meaningfully grapple with and build strategies towards countering authoritarian regimes and being more effective at strategic competition. Basically, there was some really cool, just amazing work, frankly, during the global war on terror days, but working with women on the ground in Afghanistan and other places, what that got you. We're taking the next step. What are these kinds of insights? What are these kinds of networks? What are these kinds of tools? If we were to think about that against the real, no kidding, challenges of strategic competition with China and Russia, and particularly from a military perspective, what does that get us? And look, neither Russia nor China give a crap about women, peace, and security. Right? If this whole thing is about trying to find new competitive spaces, I'm using air quotes for everybody listening, and we don't want these things to go into hot wars, right? Why not think about, working with 50% of the population and actually factoring them into our calculations, especially because, our primary adversaries have completely ceded that. By the way, the flip side of this coin is that in many cases, women's groups, women's networks, and women are standing up to autocrats and becoming the faces for and the bulwarks, faces for democratic movements and bulwarks against authoritarian expansion. That's not to say that there aren't women out there that are spoilers, and that's not to say that there aren't fascist women out there. That's not the point. The point is more that, broadly speaking, there seems to be a trend, as we've seen this rise of authoritarianism, women are fighting back, and they're key parts of this resistance to creeping authoritarianism. And so we're getting a bit into understanding that and what that can mean for, our foreign policies, our strategies, but also how we can make ourselves better.
I just have one observation here, and then Cheryl, I wanted to ask you sort of, because you've been in this industry for a very long time, and sort of what this initiative means. But that last point you made, Kathleen, about, the authoritarianism that, and it's a transnational authoritarianism, and I'm not sure I would include, I think that China is like a different flavor slightly, but the kind of
they're doubling down on anti-feminist activities, right? They are in the process of promoting, a highly militant version of masculinity. And by the way, gender doesn't just mean women, folks. It's also dudes, right? And by the way, turns out when things get better for women, they also get better for dudes. And so at the risk of making some of our listeners uncomfortable talking about different masculinities and toxic masculinities, that's a big part of this.
This is the lesson of Barbie, right? So, but to draw this back, right? I mean, one of the things that is sort of, when you can try to derive the core tenet of this transnational authoritarian movement that is definitely, that is part of the Russian conversation, part of Hungary, part of the right-wing conversation in France, right? Part of the right-wing conversation in the United States, right? This sort of embrace of particularly authoritarian visions of masculinity is unique or is, it is besotted with that, right? And it comes out in all of its manifestations. And I wasn't aware that it also was starting to come out in manifesting in Chinese authoritarianism. But, to the extent you're talking about this transnational authoritarian wave, it is very much a sort of pan-masculinist wave. And so it definitely makes sense to me that the fight against that has to be a feminist fight.
Well, and the attendant diminution of femininity, right? And women have basically, women are being encouraged to have 11 babies in Russia, or 8 or 11 babies in Russia, something now. China has made similar statements. So what I'm finding fascinating, and again, we're at the very beginning of this research. So, I could throw out a couple of hypotheses, but I may come back on the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast in a couple of years and be like, so I was totally wrong about that. So I'm going to put that caveat out there. But there is a almost like a cognitive dissonance that happens, right? So there's this doubling down on these golden age notions of masculinity and femininity that, you know, harken back to this golden age that never existed, right? But especially in the context of these societies that where women have had more rights and had, you know, more economic opportunity, returning to those golden ages, that creates frictions, that creates tensions. Like the lived experience of people in these societies is inconsistent with, you know, this notion that if we have these regressive gender roles, things are going to get better for us. Turns out they don't. That makes people cranky. And women have been said, you know, stepping up and pushing back against that. Not necessarily by critiquing the gender roles per se, but actually just being in their gender roles, saying, hang on a second, this is not okay. I'm a mother. I'm a wife. It is not okay for my partner, my son, to die in Ukraine. It's not okay. You know, anti-abortion movements as well. Like, it is not okay to take this right away from me. This is a reproductive health matter. It's nothing more, right? So we're seeing these dynamics play out in all these very, very interesting ways, and trying to wrap our brains around what this can mean for a more sensible U.S. foreign and national security policy is what we're spending some of our candle power trying to figure out. And again, early stages of the research, I may come back in a couple of years and be like, so totally wrong on X, Y, and Z. And that's okay. That's how we learn.
Cheryl, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, Kathleen is working on some very concrete issues that are really important. And I wrote a little post this week on what is called feminist foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And that phrase can cover what Kathleen is talking about and a great many other things. It has not gotten a lot of attention, and I was in one sense glad to see that the International Institute for Strategic Studies was paying attention to feminist foreign policy, and I was not at all happy with the way they did it, with advertising two men who were going to talk about it. And oh, by the way, a couple of women who actually turned out to be senior to one of the men who was in the promo and who set the stage for the women to be allowed to talk. It was altogether done very badly. But what I've been doing is more on the theoretical and policy side from what Kathleen is doing, and both of them basically work together. The theoretical side can learn a lot from what Kathleen is doing and what her projects are. And in the same way, hopefully, the more theoretical side can help to inform the direction of what Kathleen is doing. So the two of them have to really develop together. So what I mostly do is writing, and I've been writing. And there's an odd resistance, well, maybe not odd, that is kind of symbolized by that IISS podcast, in that some men simply, and these are often men who are in positions of power, like editors of magazines and journals, they simply cannot grasp that there is a critique of events and policies that is based in gender. And as Kathleen pointed out, guess what? There are at least two genders, and one of them has had a lot of power for a really long time. And that leads to certain distortions and certain assumptions that just may not be true. I won't say that it's strictly a masculinist problem with the realists and people like Stephen Walt, but gender is an element of what is going on there. And along with the assumption that Stephen Walt can speak for instance, the Finns, that's not strictly gender, but it's related to it in that Walt is a white American man, and therefore he can speak for all kinds of people. Some of us are saying, no, he can't.
Well, you know, it's also a little frustrating in that when you talk about a gender perspective, and by the way, when we talk about gender, what we're ultimately, I think, talking about is norms, behavior, very deeply encoded senses of identity. Now, it's not biological sex. It is the base codes that help construct our sense of identity and our roles within societies, and that gets also transferred into bureaucracies. It's a part of how states encode power and make decisions. So it's like the air we breathe. It's like everywhere. It's hard to see, hard to wrap your arms around, but if it's absolutely essential to being. That's an enormously rich discussion, especially when we think about strategic competition, strategic empathy, all of these things that really matter. It often gets conflated with diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, or like how many women are at a table, are the uniforms right? Those things matter. It is true. And we can't take our hands off the wheel in terms of creating institutions, workplaces, spaces where, I don't know, we can like respect each other and just like not be crappy to each other. That's ultimately what we're talking about when it talks about the DEI side. But gender in the context of strategic competition as it's playing out right now, and as we're thinking about it right now, is not about how many women are in decision-making spaces necessarily. It's more about how do states think about, and different actors, different regimes think about power. How are they expressing that power? What kinds of decisions are they making about that power? How does it inform inputs to decision-making, like Putin's Russia? Like, this gets back to the Ukraine discussion. How does a gender lens help us understand more about Putin's decision-making and what kinds of signaling would be required for him to understand don't invade NATO? I don't think we can come up with a sufficient answer without taking a gender lens into perspective.
Totally agree.
Absolutely concur.
Well, now that that's solved, I don't know. What's going to be your, I don't know.
do either of you have anything else to add before we let the listeners go?
NATO's good. Ukraine is good.
Happy birthday, NATO.
Slava Ukraine, right? And I don't remember the answer to that toast. Like, my friend Matt taught me the answer to the Slava Ukraine toast, but what the Ukrainian answer to it, and I just can't remember what it was. So, but yeah, no. Let's get together and save Ukraine.
I dig it.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let me thank both of you. Let me thank all of our listeners. And please be aware there'll be another LGM podcast coming up soon.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying as our intro and outro music, I'd Bet My Lands and Titles, a track on the album For Executive Meeting. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate at the PayPal link on the website. Thank you.